Morning.
Edmund Hillis, on behalf of Christopher Wallace, my co-counsel Lisa Mignotola is seated at council table. This is her first opportunity to appear before this court since she was admitted a few years back. Your Honor, we're here today because...
Mr. Hillis, before you start, were you delayed in traffic this morning?
We had, yes. Actually, we were a little bit delayed. The problem, though, and I apologize to the court, is mine. I had a meeting this morning, and I lost my attention for a minute, and Ms. Mignotola was actually waiting for me. So the problem with us arriving at the just at 10 o'clock out front is so totally mine, not hers. And I do apologize.
And what meeting did you have that was more important than being in the Supreme Court on time?
It wasn't more important, Your Honor, I apologize. I make no claim that it was more important. It's totally my fault for having lost my attention and not realizing the hour.
Well, it would have been customary to start the argument by telling us that rather than compounding the problem by first keeping us waiting for a meeting that wasn't as important and then not even acknowledging the fact that you kept the entire court waiting.
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't know what else to tell you. And it's a sincere apology. I would not intentionally disrespect this court, or any court for that matter.
So what was the nature of the meeting?
I was meeting with my supervisor, Mr. O'Neill, and the Superior Court Trial Unit supervisor, who I supervise, about an issue that had come up regarding a planned study that we're supposed to do. I was in the office in time. I got involved in this, and I didn't schedule it. It was an impromptu thing, and I lost track of the time, and I apologize.
You understand that all of your court appearances should be your first priority?
Yes, sir. I totally understand that, and I once again, I regret that I've caused the court inconvenience and perhaps a suggestion that I don't respect this court or its proceedings.
No, it just was surprising that you didn't acknowledge what had happened. It's because when we start argument late, it has a domino effect. We have arguments scheduled all day, and if everybody was late, it wouldn't be very productive.
I understand that, Your Honor. And again, I apologize, and I can guarantee you it won't happen again.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm here because we represent Christopher Wallace, who was convicted of first-degree murder in the Superior Court on a bench trial presided over by Judge Slight. At that trial, guilt was not contested. It was an admission and avoidance defense, which involved Mr. Wallace's mental status at the time of the offenses. He was 15 years old when he killed a 9-year-old boy who was his cousin. He was visiting that young man's family, and in what can only be characterized as a bizarre series of events, stabbed him. There were doctors that testified for both sides. All three of the expert witnesses, two psychiatrists and one psychologist, did agree that Mr. Wallace was substantially mentally ill. Judge Slights ultimately found that he was guilty but mentally ill under the Delaware statute. His background was such that all the doctors agreed that it was no one should be surprised that he ended up with the mental status that he had.
Is your argument relating to the Eighth Amendment, and I know you're arguing the Delaware Constitution, focusing on this particular defendant, or are you with a fact-intensive inquiry as to the constitutionality of the sentence to him, or is it a broader argument that anyone under a certain age cannot, as a matter of constitutional law, be sentenced to a mandatory life?
It is, we submit both. We will concentrate on this particular case because, having invoked the cruel and unusual prohibition in both the Constitution, federal and state, I believe we have put in play the proportionality with regard to this particular case also. All the jurisprudence suggests that the proportionality analysis that this court has adopted is that is federal law.
Well, if it is both, shouldn't the trial judge, who was the fact finder in this matter, somehow be involved? Because it seems like that's been totally bypassed by not raising it below.
It has, and I suppose in a perfect world, counsel would have raised it in the court below. Ms. Mignotolo and I became focused on this actually at a point after the trial proceedings, and because it does rise to constitutional dimensions, we don't believe we waived it procedurally and that it is fairly before this court, because this court has indicated that sentencing provisions that are complained of at a level of constitutionality are ripe for consideration by this court, whether they were raised below or not. So ideally, yeah, we would have contemplated the issue earlier and given the trial court an opportunity. Having said that, I do believe that the factual record is sufficient for a review on the proportionality basis.
Factual record may be, but we don't have a record of what the judge would have decided.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
we don't have the benefit of that analysis. Whether or not, well, assuming that we do entertain both arguments, would you articulate them separately for us?
Surely. The first and the broader argument is the argument that the United States Constitution and the Delaware Constitution, because the reading of the case law would suggest that's a coextensive coverage, would, under the standards originally talked about by the U.S. Supreme Court in Thompson v. Oklahoma and subsequently in the Roper case as an extension of that theory, would indicate that there is an evolving standard of decency by which the propriety of punishment under the cruel and unusual punishment prohibition ought to be examined.
This is getting very convoluted. I just want a simple statement of your broader claim. Is it that below the legal age of majority can be sentenced to a term of life imprisonment?
That is the broadest argument. Yes,
period.
Sure. Period.
Okay.
Did you file a reply brief in this appeal?
We did.
And remind me your response to Mr. Wallace's, your opponent, Mr. Wallace's position on Roper's reference to the fact that although the death penalty was unconstitutional, the fact that you could get life imprisonment without parole as a juvenile was a sufficient deterrent. And what Mr. Paul Wallace argues is that the United States Supreme Court tacitly was approving life without parole for juveniles, or it wouldn't have made that reference in the majority opinion.
Well, let's assume arguendo that is an accurate representation of what the case law meant then. I believe the federal jurisprudence suggests, at least, that this is a continuum that we're on, and that just as with Thompson v. Oklahoma addressing admittedly death, the age was at that point 16. When you get to Roper, there's been an evolution and the age is raised with regard to death. The very factors that justified that in the Roper analysis were factors that apply to juveniles generally, not just those that are subjected to the death penalty. The idea that the mind is not formed yet, that maturation of the cognitive process doesn't actually occur until the age of 25, and that therefore there is a societal judgment that they are less culpable and more susceptible to rehabilitative measures.
Well, the other part of Roper, this is a quote from Roper. When a juvenile offender commits a heinous crime, the state can exact forfeiture of some of the most basic liberties, but the state cannot extinguish his life and his potential to attain a mature understanding of his own humanity. So Roper's talking about heinous crimes. You can't take away the person's life, but you can take away the most basic liberties. And this is on the same page of the opinion where they say, quote, to the extent the juvenile death penalty might have residual deterrent effect, it's worth noting that the punishment of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole itself, a severe sanction, in particular for a young offender. So they don't focus on age. They use the word young. They use the word juvenile. And my question is, just what is your interpretation of a majority opinion that it seems to be suggesting you can take away liberties but not life, and gives a specific example of life without parole for juveniles. Doesn't that appear to be, and this is, as you know, just a couple of years old.
I believe it's a few years old, yeah, two or three.
So what if we're going to rule in your favor and say that the United States Constitution has been violated in this case, what case do we cite to support that proposition?
There is no case that indicates this. It's clearly this is a case of first impression.
And how do you distinguish Roper?
I distinguish Roper in that when one looks at the decision in Roper, there is, if you will, a presumption at the beginning that the choice is between life and death. And it is in that context that the Roper court made its decision. Now, that doesn't suggest to the court that Roper demands, as president, that you do what we're asking you to do. But it does, I believe, create a platform from which the argument is made in this case. I anticipated at some point a question about death is different. And clearly that's part of what Roper is about. A prosecutor colleague of mine suggested this is a slippery slope when a court says death is different and I agree with him, because it does put forth the idea that the punishment makes a difference. And we suggest to the court that in the context of a juvenile, life imprisonment is different for juveniles.
Can you help me understand the chain of logic that if it's a case of first impression, if it's a case where we have the Roper precedent, which at least from the dicta in there seems to suggest that life imprisonment without parole is okay, how do we get from there to plain error, meaning error that's supposed to jump off the page at the trial judge and he is supposed to recognize this even though no one raises it? How do we get to the point? I understand your argument that, you know, as a matter of constitutional law, which can evolve, that might be a ruling someday of the U.S. Supreme Court. But how do we get to plain error from that premise?
That's a difficult burden for us, Your Honor. We suggest in our briefing that because it is an issue of constitutional dimensions, that essentially what would prevent this court from hearing it is that the lawyers didn't present it properly to the trial court.
But Ridgely's question has two different parts. Let's assume we can reach it.
Yes, sir.
How do we say the trial judge was clearly wrong for not realizing what he did was unconstitutional? Where's the clear indication that this was unconstitutional and the judge should have known it before he imposed the sentence?
I can't tell you that's the case under these circumstances, Your Honor. I have to be as candid as I can with the court.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what we're suggesting to the court ultimately is that the dimensions of this are ripe for a decision of this nature. Now, no state court thus far has ruled that is unconstitutional under either their state constitution or the United States Constitution.
And no federal court either.
That's correct, sir. However, other jurisdictions statutorily, including the federal government, limit the age at which a person can be subjected to life imprisonment. That's one of the standards that we believe is a Roper-like standard. When Roper went out and looked at death in terms of what evolving society standards were. And they look not only internally in the United States, but they look to foreign jurisdictions. And
they were looking at legislative enactments, which,
yeah, and I'm sorry, Your
which
Honor.
Recognize that it's a decision for the legislature. So you're right. Legislatures could decide to do that, just as legislatures decide in some states not to have the death penalty. But the fact that that's a legislative choice doesn't mean a contrary choice is unconstitutional.
Well, I have to agree with the starkness of that statement. It truly doesn't mean that. And I don't think that that's what we're suggesting to this court, that there is some kind of assumption or a theorem that exists that says this. It is truly a matter that is subject to the discretion of the legislature in the first instance, but the legislature in this state having decided what it decided, we think this court should review it in terms of the evolving standards that we're talking about. I mean, at some point in time, a state court
like us to review it. We've talked about the problems in reviewing it under a plain error standard.
Yes, sir.
The state also suggests that you disregarded our holding in Ortiz in your briefing on the state constitutional argument, and because you didn't make an independent state constitutional argument pursuant to our statements in Ortiz, the state constitutional argument has been waived.
Our answer to that is, Your Honor, that because the jurisprudence of this state and as expressed in State v. Kelson, a 1990 Superior Court case, and the adoption in Crosby v. State by this court of the federal proportionality review standards, that our reference to the Delaware Constitution, perhaps inartfully, is an invocation of the principle that the review is indeed, the protections are coextensive. Now, certainly the state, under several opinions authored by you, Justice Holland, says that the state constitution can provide more protection. That's not the argument here. We're arguing it provides exactly the same protection as the federal case does.
And what we said in Ortiz is we're not even going to address that if it's simply a conclusory reference to the state constitution, that it's not fairly presented.
Well, we disagree about that, Your Honor. I do think it's fairly presented in this case because of the circumstances that I've mentioned.
Mr. Hill, I think, at least I understand the contours of your per se or categorical argument.
Yes, sir.
Could you just articulate your fact-specific constitutional argument?
Fact-specifically is that given Mr. Wallace's age, the mental health, the severe mental illness that is chronicled by all the doctors that examined him, his having grown up in a dysfunctional family with a father that had been imprisoned several times, with reports of homophobic themes throughout his childhood, with exposure to sexual explicit images and even what have been characterized as orgy parties.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I think it'll save us both time and you'll be able to preserve more of your reply time if you can just state the rule of law that you're asking us to adopt in order to rule your way.
Okay, I misapprehended your question. I thought you wanted to know this fact-specific basis for my
argument. Well, the fact meaning the unconstitutionality as applied to this particular defendant rather than broad-sweeping unconstitutionality, which I thought was your main argument.
With regard to Mr. Wiles specifically, we believe that the punishment is disproportionate to the crime under the proportionality analysis of the case law. And that while we admit the crime was a heinous one and it involved an innocent young child, we still believe that in an overall analysis that life imprisonment, for the reasons that we suggest support a broader application, the first prong of the argument, in this case, suggests that life imprisonment is disproportionate for a child of 15 years old when the crime is committed.
If Mr. Wallace, the defendant, were one day over the age of majority, would your argument be any different?
I think I certainly wouldn't have anywhere near the argument that I do. There's potentially an argument that because the data suggests maturity doesn't occur until much later, that some of the arguments still apply. But in this particular case, I suggest to the court that there has to be a line somewhere, just as the court has decided in death penalty issues, that there's a line at which you're no longer a child and the purposes for protecting you more than an adult exist. So clearly in this case, if it happened when he was 18 years old, I don't think I'd be here arguing before you.
Now, the factual predicate for your argument, I mean, you referred to mental health, his mental health and mental illness. The factual predicate of is the findings of the trial judge, or are you arguing that those findings are somehow clearly
wrong? No, that clearly we are not arguing that. As a matter of fact, in Judge Slight's written opinion when he found Mr. Wallace guilty but mentally ill, he uses words, and I'm going to paraphrase here, about him being severely mentally ill. Words of that nature.
And the specific diagnosis was conduct disorder, not schizophrenia.
It was on the part of Dr. Mechanic, who was the state-retained expert. He found him to have, he found him to have personality disorder, which is not possible under the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual because of his age. He then, at trial, modified that once he was confronted with that to say that he had conduct disorder. Conduct disorder is a disorder that you can only have while you're under 18.
But did Judge Slights pick among those expert opinions and rely upon the state's expert, or did he accept that there was a...
I think he characterized it simply as he was certainly mentally ill as defined by the statute. And he does talk about Dr. Mechanic, who was the state's expert, credibility over the other two experts in the opinion, and obviously relied upon what Dr. Mechanic had to say from a factual point of view more than he did on the other two doctors that defense procured. But I don't think at any point he found them to be incredible. I think the general proposition was that all the doctors indicated a substantially mentally ill person. Now, our doctors, to go back to
we don't have a factual finding by the trial court as to what the diagnosis is for your client.
I'd have to go back and look at the opinion. I do recall that I believe the fair sense of what the trial judge said was that he was relying upon, he was giving the greater weight to Dr. Mechanic's conclusion. But Dr. Mechanic's conclusion is still that he's mentally ill. It wasn't that he was schizophrenic. I mean, conduct disorder is a diagnosed mental illness.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Wallace, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, good morning. I am Paul Wallace, here on behalf of the State of Delaware, the appellee in this matter, and I guess as a matter of record, there is no relationship between myself and the defendant in this case. In a long time of prosecution, this is the only person I've ever tried with my same last name, and I've got to follow it all the way through both trial, which was somewhat confusing sometimes, and obviously the Court has heard a little bit of confusion this morning, but there should be no confusion that there is no relationship. Excuse my cold also, please. The first matter that the state would like to take up is briefly the state constitutional argument. The state suggests respectfully that the defendant has waived it under the under Ortiz, and that this court had set forth in Randall and Mathis decided after Ortiz what it was looking for when a defendant tends to argue in some way that there is a greater protection under the state constitution. Now, it appears that the appellant in this case is not arguing that his argument, or at least his belief, is that, in fact, the protections of the Eighth Amendment and the protections of Article 1, Section 11 are coextensive, that they terminate at the same place. And the state wholly agrees with that. And I believe that if we were to go through the analysis, that's pretty clear. Our cruel punishments clause comes directly from the Declaration of Rights from the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1790, or the Declaration of Rights of Pennsylvania 1790, word for word. And the Pennsylvania courts, which have addressed that specific question, note that the bounds of those phrases are exactly the same, that cruel punishment under that state constitution, which we adopted, is the same as cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. So if he were to have gone through that analysis, the state would suggest he would get gain no greater ground, that in fact all of the tests that this court has adopted, specifically in Crosby, and I'd spend most of my time on Crosby because I believe that is the most specific proportionality test for non-capital cases that this court has adopted. And I believe we go there because Roper does not get appellant where he believes it gets him. Roper, in a great deal of dicta, speaks about juveniles and the fact of how they develop and what should happen with them,
Mr. Wallace,
in relation to the death penalty.
Just so I can follow your substantive argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
That is the beyond the Ortiz waiver. Would you address separately the two constitutional claims that are being advanced here, one being a broad per se claim,
yes,
that the state can never, or that a trial judge can never sentence a juvenile to life imprisonment without probation or parole under any circumstances, and the alternative argument, which is that in this case, the trial court violated Mr. Wallace's constitutional rights by doing so.
Yes, Justice James. First, as to the per se, what they believe is a per se bar of a life imprisonment sentence under either the Eighth Amendment or the state constitutional amendment, the state denies that. There simply is no per se prohibition. This court found as much when it decided 30 years ago in State versus Spence that natural life for juvenile murder was not unconstitutional. That was one of the questions provided in 1976 when 4209 was first questioned. I believe his name was Leewood Shields, was one of the persons who raised the claim. He raised the claim under the then case, probably the only state court case, Workman versus Commonwealth versus Workman, a case out of Kentucky. And this court specifically had rejected that claim and found that even
for a juvenile or just generally?
Actually, Mr. Shields was a juvenile. He was a 16-year-old. The court doesn't say what the specific age was, but when you read the language, it says that, in fact, it is not cruel and unusual, even given his years, I believe was the phrase. I'd have to look it up again. But he was, in fact, a 16-year-old. And the question was, if, in fact, a death penalty was not available, whether or not life imprisonment was available for the list of prisoners that was, or defendants who were then facing newly revised 4209, which provided for a natural life sentence without parole. Shield specifically raised the question as to whether or not, that if the death penalty was taken off the table, whether or not life imprisonment without parole would be unconstitutional to him, as applied to him. And in fact, he urged the court to adopt a then 8-year-old case, Workman, and the court rejected that.
All right. So I mean, your response to the first argument, or the per se argument, is that there is no per se rule. Roper, if anything, goes the other way, and our jurisprudence has rejected that per se notion.
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe it rejected it 30 years ago. I believe the Superior Court rejected it in Wanham, and then I don't think Roper has changed that landscape at all.
All right. So you're I gather then that your position is that if we're going to entertain a cruel and unusual punishment claim, it has to be within the analytical framework of disproportionality.
Yes, the Crosby framework that this court had adopted, taking from Solomon and Harmelin. And the first stop in that, as this court had adopted in Crosby, is whether or not there is an inference of gross disproportionality. And there simply is none in this case. This is a murder in the first degree, and it is a sentence of natural life. The state suggests the analysis really should end there, because unless the defendant can raise that inference of gross disproportionality, and that when the court determines whether there's gross disproportionality, it gives great deference to the findings of the General Assembly as to what is an appropriate punishment. Last week, in a different context, talking about the separation of powers, this court in State versus Sturgis yet again upheld that there are differences, and the General Assembly has the strongest voice, at least, and the first and strongest voice in determining whether or not punishment is appropriate for a particular criminal act. Certainly that does not in any way discount this court's oversight under the Eighth Amendment or the state constitution. But unless there is that inference that can be drawn of gross disproportionality, the rule of Hammerlin, we do not go any further.
If this particular defendant had been found guilty, but there were no mental illness involved, just a determination of guilt without any qualification, that certainly would lend itself, I guess, most cleanly to the argument that you've just made.
It certainly would, yes, Your Honor.
Here, however, we have a finding of guilt, but also of mental illness. How does that factor into your disproportionality argument?
Well, I suggest again, Your Honor, that we must give deference to the General Assembly as to whether a person who is found guilty but mentally ill suffers the same punishment or the same consequences in punishment as one who is not mentally ill. Guilty but mentally ill does provide treatment, and that's the most important aspect of the finding. The question is whether or not that person will be separated for the rest of his or her life from society. But when one is found guilty but mentally ill, there are things that come with it under 11 Delaware Code Section 401 and 408. So I would suggest respectfully, Your Honor, that yes, obviously the cleanest argument would be if it was a straight finding of guilt. But honestly, the state suggests that the finding of guilty but mentally ill doesn't really change the calculus all that much, because this finding of guilty but mentally ill, instead of taking away from culpability, instead provides for a different form of incapacitation, that being with mental treatment at the Delaware Psychiatric Center.
Would it be fair to say then that, speaking in cruel and unusual punishment language, that the punishment here is tempered by the legislatively recognized right to treatment?
Yes, and in fact, it starts with treatment. By statute, the first place one found guilty but mentally ill must go is into treatment, or at least evaluation by the Delaware Psychiatric Center, and I'd suggest that that really is how it plays into it. It does not make the fact that one is mentally ill does not overcome, I'd suggest respectfully, the General Assembly's finding that they should be incapacitated for life. It's just where they should be incapacitated for life or under what circumstances.
Now, we do have a number of jurisdictions, I think you made reference to them in your brief, where there is no mandatory life without parole requirement for juveniles.
That is true.
And,
there are.
Well, what does that tell us? And doesn't that, if someday the U.S., if 48 states had similar provisions, that would be a clear signal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
It may, in fact, be. Right now, I believe that there are 27 that have mandatory natural life sentences for juveniles found guilty of murder. There are 42 where it's at least a possibility. And most importantly, if we want to hop onto the rope or train for a moment, it seems to be going the other way. Because at least one state, since Roper is, we're around the time of Roper, Texas, which did not permit natural life sentences for anyone in their jurisdiction, adopted natural life sentences for both adults and juveniles. So in Roper terms, we're swinging the other way, and I'd suggest respectfully, as we did throughout our brief, that has been the evolving trend in juvenile sentencing for the very violent crimes. We're not speaking against the treatment of juveniles for lesser crimes or anything of the like, but what we are speaking to here is giving fidelity to what the General Assembly has found in relation to juveniles who commit very serious offenses, and in fact offenses that it believes they should be incapacitated for the rest of their life. So I suggest that Roper, and I don't know that I need to speak about this very much, because certainly during the appellant's argument that the court probably quoted all the language that I would have anyway, but I'll speak only to the death is different argument. If I was not the prosecutor, his friend who said it's a slippery slope, I probably know who that is because it's probably somebody in the PD's office now. But death is different finds its most firm grounding in the Eighth Amendment. And I'd suggest that that's true because we have seen how it has changed. How it has changed in Atkins relating to those who are mentally retarded, how it has changed in Roper related to juveniles. But that is where it ends. And when once we leave death, then we must leave the dicta of Roper. And that, the state suggests, is where it should end. And it has ended in any court who has looked at it since then. So the state respectfully suggests that if we were to both either take the per se argument, there simply is no grounding for it, not in this state's history, not in this state's current sentencing schemes, and not when we look from outside. If we were to look at the as applied to Christopher Wallace's situation, nor do we there either. In that circumstance, this crime, we could find absolutely no proportionality problem. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Hillis, you used all of your time, but if you would like to reply, the court will give you an additional 3 minutes.
Thank you. The only area that I'll address, because I think the court's questions anticipated responses which answer the state's arguments, is the notion that guilty but mentally ill is somehow just that somebody get treatment. This court has recognized, in the context of death cases, that the guilty but mentally ill determination statutorily is a mitigating factor. And juries don't even have the ability under Delaware law to accept that or not. They are told that as a matter of law, it's a mitigating factor. And we'd suggest that that's a factor to be considered here in Mr. Wallace's case, because there has been a statutory determination that he's guilty but mentally ill, and that this court, again, in the context of a death case, but in this court has recognized that as having a mitigating effect. I'll just close by saying that I do once again apologize and regret that I have caused the court inconvenience today.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis. Mr. Wallace, the court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement and take a short recess.